Emidio Alarmenti is being interviewed by Renate Gerlich for Concord's Oral History program. The interview is taking place at his home at 69 Bayberry Road on September 10th, 2001. Mr. Armenti is 77 years old. You have been a longtime activist and vocal opponent, particularly in the anti-war movement. And that stems from your own personal involvement in World War II.
That's correct. I served in 1943 to 1946. I was a medic, a surgical technician, attached to a gasoline supply battalion, and we provided the supplies for the Third Army as we moved up into Germany. And at that time, I was serving with my detachment primarily Negro, what we called Negroes at that time, Negro companies. The Army was segregated, and we had three companies of Negro GIs who were doing most of the hard labor. And at that point, I really, although I was a long time war advocate, even in my teens. Nevertheless, this brought home to me that how bad war was, how insane war is, and particularly how the effect that it had on the blacks. Following the war, I went to Rutgers University and had a degree, bachelor's degree, and got interested in philosophy. Went to the University of California. And then following that, went to University of Michigan, where I had a PhD in philosophy. So the philosophy also gave support to the feelings I already had engendered in me, both through my early years and also through my war experience. While I was at the University of Michigan, I got involved with a group there, a very activist group who was working on affordable housing for low-income families. As this, the federal government had a village that they had put up called Willow Run Village to house war workers who were working in the Ford plant manufacturing with B-24s, and they had brought in thousands of workers from Tennessee, Kentucky, and surrounding areas to house in this little village. When the projects ended, when the war ended, the federal government had turned it over into a developers, and the housing group, the Willow Run Housing Group that I joined, sought to take a portion of that property and provide low-income housing. We're aiming primarily at low-income black families that were living in a segregated part of the Willow Village. And we were quite successful. By 1958-59, we had put up probably one of the first major federally supported affordable housing programs. So I was well on my way to being very heavily involved in social activism. By 1960, I moved into Concord with my family. By then I had four children, and I was working at MIT's Lincoln Laboratory. And fortunately, the laboratory was one of those places that it allowed its workers to use some of its time for working on socially worthwhile activities. So in the early 60s, I was able to become very active in the civil rights movement. At that time, in Concord, a fair practices committee had been set up by Marsha Stern, then Marsha Plummer, and Bob Feldmesser, and a number of the liberal concerned people of Concord, and they formed a committee called the Concord Fair Practice Committee, which was directed at trying to break down barriers of discrimination and promote tolerance and human rights. The committee, the Concord Committee, was one of some 30 or 40 committees that had sprung up in the early 60s all around the Boston area, and they were headed by sort of an umbrella organization called the Federation for Fair Housing and Equal Rights. The Federation had its headquarters in Boston, and I became a delegate to the Federation from the Concord Fair Practices Committee. I had also been chairman of the committee, and that we worked in Concord to try to break down some of the housing barriers in Concord. The Federation had, through its legislative arm, had created or helped create the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, so that we had a venue for bringing cases that in violation of discrimination laws, and our committee would conduct test cases with blacks and whites, determining whether there was how much discrimination there was in Concord, and helping blacks, at that time called Negroes, as I said, to get housing. In the early 60s, there was only a couple of families, a couple of black families, I think maybe only one black family, and the barriers against black families were very high. The Federation had established a clearinghouse in Roxbury to help black families seek housing in the suburbs. And all of the committees, under various names, human rights committees, social justice committees, in Brookline, in Newton, Lexington, and a number of other, as I say, somewhat like 30 communities. These committees, through the Federation and independently, worked together. There was a network, a communication network, that at one point was an extremely high-powered. Whenever legislation came up, especially legislations initiated by the Federation, telephone calls would go out to all of the committees in the surrounding Boston area, and the legislators would be deluged with phone calls and mailings. As a result of this activity, a number of worthwhile pieces of civil rights legislation went through. The Racial Imbalance Bill was passed as a result of the support of these committees. As a result of that bill, there was a movement to try to assist blacks to move out of Roxbury and in the ghetto areas into the suburbs. And one of the projects that came out of that was the METCO projects, the Metropolitan Education Program, which would allow black families, or minority families actually, to have the children entered into the suburban schools. The program was proposed by Leon Trilling, who was then president of the the chairman, I guess, of the Brookline Committee, and he made the proposal at a very dramatic meeting at Freedom House, which was the house where we would meet in Roxbury. And it was immediately taken up by the members of the delegates of the Federation. That was in 1965, when the METCO program was initiated. Before that, the Concord Committee in the 60s had also supported the movement that was underway across the country, headed by Martin Luther King. And we conducted a march back in 1965 to coincide with the Selma March down through Concord, a silent march through Concord. And a number of the ministers from the various churches participated in that. One of the most prominent, probably, was Arthur Jellis of the First Parish Unitarian Church, who was very much in the forefront of civil rights activities. But the Concord Fair Practices Committee immediately got on board as the METCO movement. And as a member of the committee, I went to, myself and a few of the other members of the committee, went to our superintendent of schools, who was then Ireland, Superintendent Ireland. And at this point, almost all of the superintendents in suburban areas had already accepted the idea of having children from the inner city, they entered into schools. The Concord Fair Practices Committee, school committee in Concord did not immediately give its approval. It felt that the tensions were very high. This was a period at which there was considerable hostility both from the whites against the blacks. Although Concord was a fairly liberal town, there were still major concerns over blacks coming into the town, and there was, as our committee found, there was discrimination in housing, very much so. So it was difficult for blacks to move into Concord. On the other hand, we also found that the blacks in Roxbury were fearful of moving into a town like Concord because they were concerned about the hostility that would be the harassment against their children. So when we approached the school committee, when we approached Ireland immediately said, well, he would approve, but we would have to go before the Concord School Committee. At that time, the committee was made up of, the chair of the committee was Augie Buttman. And we approached the committee. We had an appointment with the committee, and Professor Trilling, Leon Trilling, was invited out to speak to them on behalf of the METCO program. And he gave a very eloquent speech to the committee. And it was obvious that the committee was favorable the idea, but still, because of the racial tensions, the committee felt that it was not something that they could approve themselves; that there would have to be a public hearing. And so, the year 1966, the school committee decided to have a public hearing, and word got went out to the town. For the date of the meeting, I don't think the hearing was going to be held sometime in May of that year. The Fair Practices Committee spearheaded a drive to get as many of its supporters to the meeting as we possibly could. And the meeting was held in the Concord High School. It was an overflowing meeting from what I read. The meeting, the attendance was the largest that the school committee had ever had in its whole history. And the air was quite tense. The question that was before the committee was, the school committee, was whether to accept 25 school children from Roxbury into the lower grades, which would be young children. The committee under Augie Buffman's chair had made up an agenda, and the rules were that the first half of the meeting would be raising questions, and the second half of the meeting would be comments and any comments that people might have. As a representative of the Fair Practices Committee, I made a presentation for the committee, and over the course of the next hour or so, because the meeting went on for quite a while, I became astonished at some of the concerns that came out of the meeting. Concord being a highly educated community, had representatives in the audience who were from every academic phase of life, including economists, psychologists, sociologists, and every one of them seemed to have, or a number of them seemed to have, all kinds of concerns about what would happen if we brought the children into Concord. There were concerns about children from Roxbury bringing disease into Concord, that the possibility that the children would be psychologically affected because they would have to get up early in the morning and they would have to get on the bus. There was the concern that that they would not be able to go back into their communities with their friends and associate with their friends because they were coming from this elitist community. This went on and on. There was even questions about whether this was actually going to cost money, even though the state, under the legislation that was passed for Medco, would provide money to support the program. Nevertheless, there were those who had calculated, this was pre-computer time, so they probably had to do it by hand, but they calculated what the cost might be in terms of teacher hour or occupation in the classroom. Some of the calculations were really quite complex as far as determining whether 25 black children coming into Concord would be a liability or not. And at one point in the proceedings, Dr. Robert Coles came up. He had come in late in the meeting, so he didn't realize what the rules were. But he spoke up at the time when he wasn't really supposed to, and he was outraged. At this point, Dr. Coles was not well known. He had written his book on children in the South. He had spent, I guess, 5 years in the South working with black children, and so he was quite an expert on integration and on the discrimination, rather. And he stood up and he said, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, he made remarks that he had never heard so much in the way of discriminatory remarks, even when he was in the South, and he had never heard so many things of this kind. He was quite outraged by it. But the upshot of the meeting was that following the meeting, they didn't make a decision at that time. The following meeting, the committee did approve Medco. And of course, since then, Medco has proved to be quite successful in Concord. There have been difficulties now and then. But the program, metropolitan-wide, has been very successful. The level of students coming through the program is fairly high. The percentage that went on to college is very high. So that despite some setbacks, it's been a very successful program.
As a matter of fact, this has been the 35th year.
35th year. Yeah. We've been operating. And since then, the Fair Practices Committee, all the committees have pretty much dissolved. All through the 60s, the civil rights movement had changed quite a bit, had changed the tone of the civil rights movement considerably, and of course with the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the then the death of Martin Luther King, some of these barriers, many of the barriers came down. Despite this, Concord, at this date, in 2000, we still have a very small number of black families. I don't think there are more than 7 or 8 black families living in Concord.
When you first came, you said there was only one black family that you knew. What were their names?
Peggy Evans and Dick Evans were the family, and they happened to be... And it was not unusual that they would be living in Concord, since Dick Evans had grown up in a white community in Lexington, so that he was already pretty much acclimated to the white community, had none of the fears that the blacks in Roxbury had.
Wasn't Peggy with the school system?
Peggy was served in the Concord school system as a counselor?
Guidance counselor,
yeah, for a number of years.
Besides Augie Buttman, who were some of the other school committee members that approved MECO?
Well, the whole committee was included Barbara Anthony, Dave Emerson, Bob Jacobs, and Michelle Lombardo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they accepted the 25 students.
And that was quite a major...
That was a major accomplishment of the Federation and for the committees that participated, because that has grown to be quite a successful project. Well, but during that same period, after the march in Selma, the nation was pretty much quite in arms about, and quite divided between whites and blacks as to the movement, because you were having, the whole South was changing considerably. Blacks were going to be allowed in hotels, they can drink out the same fountains, they could go to the same bathrooms, go to the restaurants, you know, all those changes came about in a rather rapid fashion, beginning with the 60s on up and through the 70s. And here in Massachusetts, we still have a long way to go. In fact, there were some that felt that the racial hostility was greater in the North than it was in the South. Very much so. There was quite a
Well, actually, the communication wasn't there, as you said, between blacks and whites and Concord. So the outreach to the inner city, I think, becomes interesting, going in to Roxbury, meeting with blacks there. I'd like you to tell me about that, how it was received, and it's tense.
It was very tense. It was so tense that those of us in the suburbs, even though we were well-educated, people, almost all the members of these committees were very well-educated, college graduates, all of them. Nevertheless, we didn't even have the language for discussing the island. It was not clear whether you were called them Negroes, whether you were called them colored. You had an NAACP, which is a youth colored in its title. But at that time, we were even concerned about inviting blacks to come from the inner city because we didn't know what the social protocols were to meet with them and how we would talk with them. And this despite the fact that there were some extraordinary well-educated blacks in the inner city who were leaders there, Ruth Batson, a marvelous person, Paul Parks, Tom Brown, Tom Atkins, who ran for assembly in Boston, Mel King, who later became quite an important leader in his own right. So we had difficulties, but the white communities were trying all kinds of programs that they thought would help break down the barriers. We would go in, we would have groups of people go into Roxbury, which is still exists incidentally today. I'm very surprised at it, but of going into Roxbury and into the ghetto areas to help fix the playgrounds up, help fix the work on houses, clean up yards and things of this kind, in conjunction with the black communities. There was an employment education center that was started up, OIC, Office of Employment, but it was OIC was started up, and white educated teachers from college levels would go in and try to teach courses on a volunteer basis, all on a volunteer basis. We had one episode in Concord, which I thought was, looking back now, was rather amusing. I had arranged with Mel King to have a group of Concord people go into Roxbury on an evening to meet with residents of Concord to have an exchange. It was just a simple social exchange so that we could try to break down some of the barriers. And we had chartered a bus to go in. We had about, I guess, 20 of us on the bus, something like that. And we went in. It was dark at night. And of course, people at that time were also fearful of being in Roxbury at night. So we were there, and we pulled up to the multiple education center. I think I know what the exact title of the center was that Mel King headed. And we were able to go in and get inside, but nobody was there. There was only the janitor, as far as I know, was there. No one was there. And we sat there and we waited, and then one of the staff members came around trying to find out what we were doing there. And I told him that we were here to meet Mel King. And eventually, word got through to Mel, to King, and he did show up, but he wasn't apologetic. That was the interesting thing, was he sort of, at that point, he sort of resented what we were doing. I don't know whether it was because he felt that we were patronizing him, whether he was trying to cover up his embarrassment, maybe, at having made the arrangement and then not and having forgotten it. It was a time when the blacks couldn't trust whites in the suburbs. So it might very well have been that at that time, Mel King just thought, yeah, sure, they're going to come into Roxbury, but it will never come off. He didn't believe it. And I can understand why. After that, the situation improved considerably as far as our interaction was concerned. But the situation was still very difficult. The housing situation was terrible. The Federation was trying all through the 60s to try to reach the blacks from different points of view. There was the education, there was housing, and there was employment, which was a major concern. And two of us, Marty Gulpin, who was connected with the Social Action Center in Roxbury, who was white, he and I got together and came up with a plan to try to improve the travel from Roxbury out to where the jobs were on 128. We met with a lot of personnel people in all of the 128 plants. At that time, it was called the Electronic Highway, and it was the really the beginning of the boom period for high-tech in our area. And all of the high-tech companies were out either on 128 or west of 128. Even 495 was not developed at that point. So companies like iTech and the other electronics plants were all out. EE&G was another one. We met with the personnel, Marty Gopin and I met with the personnel departments, and they were very, very pleasant, very willing to meet with us, and we tried to come up with a plan that would provide a means for the inner city residents to get out to 128 where the jobs were, because there were no jobs in Roxbury or Boston. And they were very much in favor of the program, but the more we talked with them, the more we found that it was not going to work, because there were too many concerns, like whether if they underwrote a charter bus service. And Marty and I then realized that it was going to be that we couldn't go that route, although we continued to try. But then in 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And members of the Civil Rights and Human Rights Committees all over, they were blacks as well as whites, had been meeting on a regular basis. So the CORE, we were meeting with the CORE, NAACP, Urban League, all of those, and including CJC, Congress of Jewish Community. The Jewish community was very, very supportive in all of these efforts. In fact, played a very critical role in all of the civil rights work that was being done in Boston. Many of the Jewish lawyers were helping out on a voluntary basis. And the Jewish Committee, I guess it was the AJC, American Jewish Committee, this chapter in Boston was very, very much at the forefront of all these activities. When Martin Luther King died, was assassinated, there was just a wave of, absolute wave of emotional tension that developed in the community, in the human rights community, civil rights. There was anger, outrage, total outrage. And a meeting was held in Boston, at which the frustrated members of all these various committees, the human rights committees in the suburbs, and the delegates to the Federation, and all these other human rights committees, they just were totally frustrated. And Marty Gopin and I gave a short presentation on what we had been working on, the Employment Express, what we call the Employment Express. That is an attempt to try to get an employment transportation system. And they immediately took it up and decided, boy, this was something very tangible, very, very well defined. We could do it. And the next thing, I think it was the next day, but I'm not sure what the day, how many days went by, it was a march on the MBTA. And the committee, the board, the MBTA board was confronted with very angry group of human rights people who proposed that a bus route be established between Roxbury and 128. And within a very short time, they put it in place. And in fact, it was written up in the Globe. And my understanding is that it's still operating today. How successful it was, I haven't had time to check on. But it was a bus line that went from Roxbury Center right out to the 128 to the Waltham area.
to where presumably they could get transportation to the jobs. So that was at least an attempt at trying to do something in this very complex, it's a very complex cultural situation. Then in,
the Vietnam War.
Yeah, then by 1970, we were into, very heavily into the Vietnam War, and it had been growing, and I, along with so many other human rights adherents, felt very strongly from the very beginning, we felt that this is the wrong model. And we had many, many meetings and discussing what should be done and what can be done. And there were demonstrations. I was a part of every demonstration. There were whenever the call went out to go somewhere for demonstrating, holding up signs, standing on the highways. But there were a lot of others. I mean, I was just one of many we were small groups, but it was a very, very earnest, very, very dedicated group of cadre people, essentially, core groups that were in constant touch with each other all over the Boston area. And when the word got out, people would just show up. Signs would be made on sticks, whatever they could make, and we'd march and protest. In 1971, there was a movement by the Vietnam veterans to protest the war, and a group of them came into Concord, led by, at that time, by John Kerry, now Senator John Kerry, and they organized a march from Concord to Bunker Hill, which is going to be the reverse march of the march that the British took in 1775, right, in the other direction. And it started here in Concord, and a number of the Concordians, the core group of liberals, showed up at the Minuteman Park, where they had camped for the night and provided breakfast for them, and then marched with them to Lexington. They marched down Lexington Road, taking the Battle Road to Lexington. And there were, I don't know how many Vietnam veterans there were. It wasn't a large group. I think it may have been 50 or 60. I don't think it was a very large group. But as we walked along Lexington Road, people would come out and join us. By the time we got into Lexington, on Lexington Green, there was a considerable number of people, of supporters. There were some over 300, I believe, that showed up on the green.
And this was over the Memorial Day weekend.
The Memorial Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
My son Jimmy was with me. He was, I guess he was, 17, 52, I guess he was 18 or 17 or 18. And my concern, of course, was that he might be drafted. And many people who were thinking maybe we should send our kids out to Canada, avoid the draft. Conscious subject to these wrongs was on the minds of so many of the people here in this area who were against the war. But we all met thinking that it was simply a meeting on the green with the veterans. There was a platform that was set up with microphones, and there were speeches were being given. And the veterans were in their army fatigues and uniform. It was battle fatigues, battle uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But within a very short time, when we met on the green, word got out that the selectmen, the Lexington selectmen, were opposed to having them on the green on the grounds that this was a special sanctified location, that it was not a place for protest, it was a place to be honored for the men who had fallen at the beginning of the Revolutionary War, and ordered the veterans to leave. Well, the veterans decided no, they were not going to leave, they were going to stay, and all through the evening, it's all through the afternoon and into the evening, there was a sessions going on between the selectmen and representatives of the veterans. While those of us who had come were not prepared to stay for an overnight vigil, we were there, we thought it was just going to be in support of the veterans. But as evening came on, it started getting cold. Despite the fact that it was May, it was still getting cold, and people, residents in the Lexington area, began bringing out blankets for a number of their family members. And of course, I was there with lots of friends, and I could take advantage of their blanket because I was from Concord. We weren't about to leave the green. And as the evening wore on, it got more and more tense. And announcements would be made from the platform by the veterans, telling us of the progress that was being made to try to persuade the selectmen to say it was okay. But by the end of the evening, no progress had been made. The selectmen were insisting on that they had to leave the green, and the vets were insisting they were not going to leave the green. And so the selectmen issued an order to the police, ordering them to arrest those of us who were on the green on charges of violating the town ordinance. And so this went on until about 2 in the evening, very early. I'm not sure exactly what time, but about 2 in the evening, the Lexington police, dressed in riot gear, with helmets and visors, you know, all of the things you see on TV, had come in school buses, maybe a half a dozen school buses, and marched us onto the school buses to take us to jail, which turned out to be the Department of Public Works warehouse or utility house in Lexington, and we were just herded onto the buses. No one was reluctant to go. Some who were left behind complained bitterly to the police that they wanted to go as well. So this was quite a supportive group of supporting the veterans. It was not it was not just a rabble, and these were. The people who were there were many of them professionals, heads of their presidents of the companies, or heads of major projects. I know I was there with my group leader from MIT, Lincoln Lab, and other members of the group leaders who were all there, but feeling very strongly that the veterans should be honored in their way for what they were doing. So we spent the night at the warehouse, at the DPW warehouse, lying on the floor. And the next morning, we were taken by bus to this was Sunday morning, a special session of the court was held in Concord. And we marched into court, and my recollection was Judge Ford. Was the judge?
Forte?
No, I think it was Ford.
Ford?
I believe it was Ford, F-O-R-D. Mm-hmm. That's my understanding. And we went through just a simple procedure, marching up, and we declared that we had violated the law, and it was a misdemeanor. We were represented by volunteer lawyers from Lexington, and we pleaded noli contendere, charged each $5 or something like that. None of us felt that we were criminal in any sense of the word. And it wasn't a joke, really. We didn't think of it as a humorous occasion, but we thought it was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. All of us. It was nonsense. And while we were on the green, we discussed this, and we just could not believe that a board of selectmen, all of them reasonably intelligent people, would go to the lengths that they went to. And in some ways, it compares with what went on in Concord and Metco. We could not believe, the supporters of Metco could not believe that it would create such a disturbance in the town, that there would be so much disagreement or so much controversy over an issue which we thought of as being so reasonable. 25 young children coming into our school system, black, because they were black. And this was at a time, in the Metco case, this was at a time when we had tuition students coming from outside of Concord. So, I mean, it was an extraordinary occasion. Not only that, but it was a time when we started, this was on the verge of the busing issues that grew into real high tension disturbances in Boston, which came, I guess they came a little later than this. But even there, what struck us is that the opposition to the idea of busing children into the school was already being a matter of discussion. And if you looked across the country, a large fraction of the students in the country, especially in rural areas, were bused. Mm-hmm. We even had students being bused into to go to the Catholic school in Concord, Rose Hunter. But in any case, the idea of our being arrested, locked up for a night, just appeared totally ridiculous to us. And of course, it proved in some ways to be a stimulus for the anti-Vietnam movement.
Well, 30 years later, we both saw a video that was made of that event at the Museum of Our National Heritage. What was it like looking back at it 30 years later?
Well, I was called by one of the organizers of a project called the Oral History Project to commemorate they call it the Lexington Oral History Project to commemorate the march and the sit-in on Lexington Green. And this was headed up by a woman named Catherine Bell and mm-hmm. a number of other people. And they asked us to just speak about our experience on the Green. And we were videotaped for the interview. I individually, mm-hmm. I was taped at the interview. And then as you point out, all of this has been put together, and it's now part of an archive in Lexington. I don't know how many people actually were interviewed, but they tried to reach as many of the people who were on the Green at the time as they possibly could. Then, as you point out, they had this showing a presentation. The presentation, the video itself, was more on the Green, on the activities on the Green. It didn't include, except for a small number, I guess there were a few people who had been interviewed who also were included. But it was, I was struck by the fact that it was held at the American Heritage Museum, and the auditorium was overflowing. People were just there from Jones. Most of them, I have to say, were people who had participated. Quite a few of them had participated in the demonstration. But it was a very, very moving presentation of what went on the Green. And speakers came on also who participated, who spoke on their behalf. A number of people had some very interesting stories of their own to tell and how difficult it had been. Some of them Vietnam veterans who were essentially appalled at the response. And considering the history since then, those of us who were there feel vindicated. We feel, still feel, those of us that were, and those who were at the showing of the movie had no regrets whatsoever. As far as they were concerned, the Vietnam War was an unnecessary war. It was an outrageous war. It was a war that the United States got into for worst of possible reasons. And so we were very much felt that this was our part in it, whatever that part was, in trying to bring it to an end, was worthwhile.
You had mentioned to me, with social action, it's okay to get mad. You're consistently pushing against existing forces.
Exactly, yes, that's absolutely true. It's my view, this is of course my personal view, is that the cultural forces and the political forces at work in our society make it very difficult to bring about social change of the kind that we want. The kind of social change that the racial discrimination, anti-discrimination, tolerance, anti-war, peace. So that from our point of view, at least from my point of view, you have to be angry. It's a matter of when you see night after night news reports on TV or in the papers, read them in the newspapers, and you see how our political governments operate. It's very difficult to restrain your anger. Now, during the civil rights movement, there was a considerable question about supporting groups like the Panthers or the SNCC, student for that SNCC was NSCC, but at times, I felt that the anger within these groups must have been so intense that they just could not restrain themselves. Even though I did not believe in violence, I never did believe in violence, and I never would participate in a violent demonstration. Nevertheless, I could understand perfectly those people who would make protest. Father Carrigan, an example, who would go to such incredible lengths, and even at the expense of being put in jail, in support of human rights. To my mind, it's very difficult for social action activists not to be respond with a certain degree of anger whenever. And when you consider that, as far as I can tell, the social activists that I know here are social activists 24 hours a day. It isn't something that they do for fun. It is not a hobby. It's not avocation. They're not simply running up against the conventions. They don't want to necessarily stand out as people who are opposed to the conventions of the day. They simply see what's going on in our society, and they feel very, very strong. They just can't sit still. They've got to do something about it. And in fact, these are people, when they read an article in a newspaper that irritates them or angers them, immediately go to their computer or their typewriter and start writing letters, or make phone calls, or call their congressman. They're involved in the political action on a daily basis, in campaigns and getting candidates elected. These are the people that I've been with all my life. And these are what I call the social and political activists, and I don't think they should be given a bad name. I think these are the people who make things happen.
So it's a lifetime commitment.
It's a lifetime. Well,
and it's hard work.
And you don't even, I never ever thought of it as something that I had to choose to do. It's not a choice that I make. It's something that I do because, just because I get mad. As you said, I just get angry. I've got a quote on my refrigerator, which this is a quote from Margaret Mead. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. I believe very strongly that it's relatively small groups of individuals will bring about changes. And if you look through this whole civil rights movement, and you can pick out just a handful of individuals, Martin Luther King, for one. But they're in a great number. They're not hundreds and thousands of people. Yeah. They're a relatively small number who then get the support of other people, because most people, most people have a difficult time getting involved. I understand that perfectly. But as we found in Concord, when we needed people to support, and the Concord Fair Practices Committee needed people to support us at the town public hearing, they came out in droves. They gave us the support. Well, then, I guess that brings us up through the 70s, pretty much. I know in the 80s, what occupied me was the Contra War. Mm-hmm. Again, I was very angry, along with all of others. The war against Nicaragua was a wrong war. The support of the Contras could never be adequately justified. The whole United States history of involvement in Nicaragua has been a poor one. We have sent Marines. We've insisted on maintaining control over Nicaragua going way back into the early 20th century. Our history is one of supporting dictators in Central America, and in Nicaragua was no different. And even though our concern, those of us who were mostly opposed to the Contra War, had been students. Many of us had been students of Central America, and for some years, so we knew what the history was in these countries, and we became very concerned because we knew that the war in Nicaragua was basically a war against the poor people of Nicaragua, the peasants, the people who were living in conditions of poverty primarily, and that I personally did not believe that we should support one side or another. It was clear to me that the U.S. policy was the wrong policy in Nicaragua, and that it was a mistake for us to supply the Contras with weapons and weapons of war. So a number of us, a close friend of mine, Gene Schefflin, who was living in Concord at the time, and I thought that, actually it was Gene's idea, that we might contribute to a peaceful resolution of the difficulties between the United States and Nicaragua by starting a sister city program. At that time, I should go back. General Eisenhower, 1954, to his credit, recognized that war was not a solution for the ills of the world, and proposed a program called the Sister City Program. This was in 1954, and recommended that cities and towns across the country establish relationships with other cities and towns around the world. The idea being, and he said this directly, that it would be better for people to know people directly face to face on a personal basis than operate entirely through our governments. In fact, he says that going through the government is probably the wrong way. That people have to establish good relationships with one another. So a Sister City program was established, and it became a national effort, and by the time we here in Concord got involved, there were already quite a few Sister Cities. I don't know, maybe hundreds of Sister Cities, was connecting with something like 1,000 cities all over the world. Even city relationships with cities in Russia, which at the time was involved in the Cold War. Even then there were relationships that were established with all the Eastern European countries, but not Central America. Or at least not many. Although, strangely enough, Concord, and I think again it was led by Augie Butman, had established a sister city with Costa Rica. No, it wasn't Costa Rica. I think it was Honduras. I have a record of that, but I would have to check. But it, for a short time, there was a sister city relationship that was established with either Nicaragua or Honduras, a city in Honduras, and that lasted a very relatively short time, and that must have been somewhere in the late 60s or 70s. Wisconsin, from the very early years, had established a sister city state with Nicaragua. But during the Contra War, the...
So you're talking about 1980.
1980. During 1980, the sister cities were established across the country, specifically with Nicaragua. And our committee, which again was formed from... supporters that have pretty much the core group of people in Concord who have been social activists. One of them, Emily Zip was certainly one, Gene Rosner, real power, strong supporter, and a member. I don't want to name too many names because I'd be leaving out names. But the we had decided that the town that we would choose would be one that would fit certain criteria. We wanted it to be reasonably like Concord, sort of a rural type town, that it would be relatively small, same population, roughly the same population, and that it would be easy for us to get to it because we wanted to have real communication with the people in the town. And that's how we chose San Marcos, which is just about maybe 40-minute drive south of Managua. And it's essentially a coffee-growing area of Nicaragua. And we immediately, we went through town meeting to establish it, this was in 1986, we went to the 1986 town meeting, and we won overwhelmingly in favor of it. I gave presentations
before the committee and others as well, before the town meeting, I should say. And we then started over from 1986 to 1987, we made contact with the, we sent, exchanged sort of official documents from San Marcos to the mayor's office down there. The mayor was a woman named Marlena Cruz, marvelous woman, extraordinary marvelous. And we had, the board had drawn up, the board of selectmen had drawn up sort of an official document. The Central American countries are very big on very formalized documents. And so we, and even though they're very poor countries, Nicaragua are very poor countries, they have a shortage of everything, including paper. So making up a formal document was in itself a very costly effort on their part. But we made contact with Marlena Cruz, the mayor. But then we ran into someone in town who was opposed to our position. And there's a man named Al Foreman, and he spent the following year, 86 through 87, trying to undermine the Sister City Meeting Committee and its project. And we were blasted with, let's say the committee was blasted with letters to the editor condemning us as being Sandinistas, being pro-communists, that we were un-American. And during that year, we tried to respond in letters to the editor. Stu Weeks sponsored a debate. What he called himself, the Center for American Studies, in which I was face to face with Al Foreman, and turned out to be just a preaching to our own forces. We dominated. I mean, there could be Sister City people dominated, but essentially we simply he asserted, reasserted his charges against our program, and I tried rather weakly, I'm afraid, to defend our position. But in any case, that went on throughout the entire year, and then in 1987, he entered a citizen's petition for an article in the Warrant to repeal the 1986 vote of the committee of the town. And we won again overwhelmingly. The strange thing about Al Foreman, which we never could understand, was that he moved into Concord somewhere in 85, late 85, or 86, and immediately took up this opposition to our committee. And what came across to us is that he didn't understand Concord whatsoever, or the Concord mentality. He charged us with things which just were outrageous, and which anybody who lived in the town at any length of time would recognize as being outrageous. And he had lectures. He invited Nicaraguan Nicaraguan exile to come to speak. He never gained any major support. He did get a number of people in Concord who were opposed to our project. Some of them, I think, were connected with exiles, Nicaraguan exiles, to oppose us. But we were successful in getting through the 1987 town meeting, and over the last 16 or so years, we've been extremely successful in promoting the programs that we wanted. We've all gone down, almost all of the members of the board on the committee have gone down and met individually with Nicaraguans. We now have a chairman of the board. I was co-chair with Gene Rosner for those years, and then a couple years ago, Steve Bloomfield became my co-chair. And we have a number of people, including Steve, who speak fluent Spanish. He was in the Peace Corps and worked with at Harvard with the department dealing with Central American and South American students coming into the United States. So he is very knowledgeable. He's able to communicate easily. We have had a great deal of difficulty in the communication area because in the early years, that is in the following 87, in the early years there were no telephone lines to speak of. The country is totally impoverished. They had an earthquake in Nicaragua, I don't know when, and all their lines of communication had been destroyed. the roads, when we went down, I went down in 87, were totally, almost undrivable. The vehicles that you rode in were broken down vehicles that often didn't make it to the destination, and I was involved in some of that as well, as well as the others. But when we went down, we were received so wonderfully by the people. These were people who just were so gracious, and we stayed. They just put us up in a house. I was Gene Shepman and I stayed at the house where there was hardly any room for the family, and they, nevertheless, they put us in one room on the side, and for one room in the house made up of stacked up newspapers. There's a wall. The wall was a stacked up newspaper. Very gracious people. And over that period, we managed to raise quite a bit of humanitarian aid to support them because they were in desperate need of everything. We provided all told something like $40,000 worth of humanitarian aid over there, all supported by voluntary contributions from our supporters in Concord and the outlying districts. We just send out letters every year, and they send us money, and we just tell them what we've done. And what we did was in the early years we established a fully equipped dental clinic for them, which they never had. They had no room. At the health center, we provided all kinds of medical provisions. Doctors in Concord have supplied us with medical materials that we sent around. And most time in the early years, at least, these had to be taken by suitcase. Anybody who was going down to Nicaragua, down to Managua, we would load them up in a suitcase. And so we would even get volunteers to contribute old suitcases. So that was part of the baggage that we could down. And in the 80s, somewhere in the 80s, we had high school students go down, a couple of high school students. One of them was really, really a great credit to, I think, to Concord and to the whole project. This is Megan Sandel, who was a high school student who went down with his father for a week or so in San Marcos and helped out in the health clinic. She came back to the United States, went to medical school, is now a doctor, a pediatrician, working at Children's Hospital, just recently married, and has gone down this year. This was in, well, I guess it was June of 2000. And went down and spent some more time down there, and they welcomed her with open arms, and people came, she said, from all over the rural area to the health clinic to get help from her. You know, she was just overwhelmed. we've provided materials for the school system, they have no desks. The kids would carry chairs on their heads into school. We have pictures of the kids carrying chairs into the school. I mean, we provided funds for the local carpenters to build the school desks. And that was came out of our fund. All of the money that we receive goes entirely into the projects. There's no money that any of us will take. All volunteer. Bank about 3 years ago, which would be 97, I guess it was, we started a micro bank. This is a system of, we provide a local committee headed by Maria Dolores Maria Dolores Cruz, who heads up a volunteer group in San Marcos and manages money that we send down in a bank, in a bank account, and the money is lent out very low amount for cottage industry type enterprises. Mm-hmm. Just local retail stores, one coffin casket maker, people who are just doing, have small businesses, startup businesses, and they borrow something anywhere from $100 maybe to $500, which is big money at low interest rates. And that's been going now for 3 years. We now have, as of this date, 2001, we have $13,000 in the account, and we'll continue to add to it. We've also provided tuition expenses for students, four students who are going into college from San Marcos. So it's been quite a ride. It's a
sounds rewarding and successful, and now 15 years old.
Yes, and that was the remarkable thing to me, is that it's lasted, continued to last as long as it has.
Well, thank you.
Well, along with my work with the San Francisco City Committee, which has now become pretty much a rather routine kind of project, since we meet once a month, we decide how we're going to use funds that are attributed to us, and it's been going along quite well. I was also involved with a group that got started by, I think primarily, Judy Scott Mickey and Carol Dwyer. I think those are the two principals who started up the Grassroots Action for Peace. This was in opposition. It was started in opposition to the Persian Gulf War, and we carried on a demonstration in typical fashion with many supporters at the Concord Center back in the at the beginning of the Persian War in opposition to it. And
so that's like the 1990s.
Yeah. From 1990s to 2000. And Grassroots Action for Peace has continued over those years and has a number of successes. There was a petition that was gathered of from about 14 towns in the area of people who in support of cutting the defense budget back in the early 90s, which, whether how much of an effect it had, we don't know, but it certainly affected our own congressional delegation. It was very an impressive effort on our part. Major forums have been held by the Grassroots for Peace, a forum on pollution, weapons pollution around the world, particularly nuclear weapons. And this was also connected with opposition to the development of weapons made by our own nuclear metals incorporated in Concord. The Grassroots Action for Peace was very much opposed to our having being part of the war effort in Persian Gulf, and focused particularly on the use of penetrators, the nuclear penetrators, which was believed, and I think rightly, to cause considerable illness.
Depleted uranium,
the tips which were made by nuclear metals. Then another group was started up in 1990 called the CREW, Citizens Research and Environmental Watch, by Mary Jane Williams and Judy Scott Nickey and a number of others, and I was one of the early supporters of it and have continued to be one of those, and it's grown to be quite an active group over the years. They focused entirely on the non-political issue. The CREW was concerned primarily with pollution caused by the nuclear metals, which is now called StarMet.
Now, it seemed that both groups were formed at the same time.
Pretty close. And there's a considerable overlap of the two groups. Very considerable overlap. Although CREW, I think, probably has many more people supporting it who are not sympathetic necessarily to the grassroots anti-war policies, which is the central issue for grassroots is anything having to do with wars by the United States. Defense system, the missile system, and they're opposed to the landmines, they're opposed to the use of depleted uranium penetrators, they're opposed to. Whereas CREW has focused entirely on the technical question of are we being harmed, is the Concord being harmed by the pollution caused by nuclear metals. Nuclear metals has been in existence since late 1950s, and in the early years there were no real regulations basically to control any of the the output from the stacks, any of the emissions from the stacks, and there was concern that the air was being polluted by the output from some of the processing of the depleted uranium. Then, by 1990, it had grown to the point where there was major concern over the waste material that had been stored in the behind.
The holding base.
It's called the holding basin. And to some degree, the rest of the site, which I think is a 64-acre site, something like that, a large site, and the fact that depleted uranium was building up in the backyard of StarMet, and not only was it an immediate threat if you went into there, because it's the radiation level is 1,000 times background, very high. But the concern was that it might get into the groundwater and seep into the water going into the Assabet River, which is borders StarMet. So the CREW's efforts was primarily technological. Expert investigator, a man named Resnikov, to do testing, and he produced reports, and he still is working with CREW to produce reports. And all through the 90s, the CREW, just to hit the high points, they had an article in the Warrant. An article was put in the Warrant by CREW to have a committee form, which was called the Article 41 Committee, because that was the number of the article. I believe this was 97. And a committee was formed, headed by one of the crew members, actually Pam Rockwell, and a number of others who were appointed by the town manager. And their job was to review tests that were being made of soil samples that were being taken around StarMet to find out if there was any pollution that might be harmful.
I guess they were focused on air emissions.
Air emissions, yeah. Their primary concern was air emissions, that's right.
And this is the time when they're excavating, removing the holding basin under a protective bubble.
Yes, the StarMet had gotten money from the Army, which was its contractor for the penetrators, and so they started moving the material out, and they did have a canopy that they put over the basin because there was concern that in the course of moving the materials, even though the StarMet said that there was little danger, nevertheless there was sufficient concern that a canopy was placed over the basin while the materials were being removed. They were packaged in some kind of bricks, I guess, and taken off to a railroad depot where they were transferred to, I believe, Utah for safe storage. That process has been going on since then, and it still is going on because even though a considerable amount of material was removed, something like this 8,000 cubic yards was removed, there is still a sufficiently large amount of material that's still there that's highly radioactive that it's a cause of concern. And the crew continued to work both with the DEP and with other and the Department of Public Health to see if we could do more to bring about a resolution of the problem there, and particularly to bring it down to some kind of a level that would be acceptable to residential living, because as circumstances now stand, the site is so heavily contaminated that it would probably not meet either industrial or residential level of acceptance. So early in the, let's see, I guess it was 2000, a crew approached EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, to see if they could get the StarMet placed on the list Superfund sites. Turned out to be a relatively lengthy process, and it was going on for something like 6 months to a year maybe. Early this year, I think this was in 2001, the environment, EPA, did place the StarMet on the Superfund list, and now it's under the under rules. The cleanup is under will be conducted under the rules of the EPA. Crew's concern, I should mention this. I think this is important to mention. The critics of the crew, a number of them felt that a crew's aim was to drive StarMet out of business. That was its chief concern. I was with crew from 1990 on, This came up on in discussions, and my recollection, and certainly I felt this way, that that was not the aim. It was never, at least, a principal aim of Kruger in there. The aim, what Kruger was concerned with, was particularly providing a means, financial means, for StarMed to continue to operate, but at least to the point where it cleaned up the pollution of the high level of radiation. That was its main concern. I think that continues to be the concern of Kruger, and I think that was its aim all along.
I guess from a social activist point, what you see here was a determination by a group that wasn't necessarily well received at first to keep on pushing its agenda.
Yeah, I think that's characteristic not only of the social action that I've been involved in, but I think in social action in general. By and large, what drives those, I think most groups, is they're faced with what they feel is an immoral or unjust situation, or a situation which is very injurious to the people around them, the people they feel strongly about, whether it be blacks, or whether it be children, or whether it be health concerns, whatever the concern is. I think social action for me, and certainly mine, we don't simply go out looking for a problem and say we're going to make life difficult for the people that we feel strongly against. It's just the opposite. We see a problem that's created, and we try to find ways. Usually we start out, most of us start out, trying to work within whatever the system is, whether it's the legal system or, well, we always stay within the legal system, but whether it's the legal system or the moral system, the evidence system. But invariably, I should say, the majority of the people, I have to say this, the majority of people don't view the social action groups that way. By and large, they think of them as fringe groups, as radicals, as people who are malcontents, who are out to create problems and disturb. And most of the time, all of the activities that I've been involved in, going all the way back to civil rights, have eventually been activities which have proved to be correct from the point of view of the majority. Even those people who have been most strongly opposed would have to admit today that blacks are better off than they were when the civil rights movement started. I think, I don't know if it's a majority, but I think a large percentage of Americans now believe that the Vietnam War was wrong. I think the case can also be made that most Americans if you surveyed them, would say that we were wrong to support the Contras in Nicaragua. I think that it was wrong to oppose establishing sister cities in Central America. I think this is what most people today would believe. And it seems as though almost you can define social action in those terms. That is, it is an attempt on the part of what I think are well-meaning, moral, righteous people to work as best they can to try to solve a problem which most people either don't see as a problem or are unwilling to accept as being a problem to be solved.
And so the techniques are very similar. Letters to the editor.
Letters to the editor are use the instruments that are available in our society, whether it's getting on TV, getting on radio, demonstrating publicly, writing letters to the editor, meeting with their congressman, meeting with congressmen. They are probably the most knowledgeable people
as far as the country. You ask the average citizen who their congressman and who their state representative is, they don't know who they are. The social activist people not only know who their congressmen are, they know the legislation that's being considered before the legislature. Very, very few people, for one reason or another, mostly because they lead very, very busy lives, and following Thoreau, maybe lives of discontent, but they don't see it the way the social activist does, and it's not something that the social activist or political activist chooses to do. It's just something they have to do. I have another quote for you. This is people say, many people have told me this, is why are you beating your head against the wall? I mean, it's a lost cause. What you're fighting are lost causes. And the quote I always remember is Victor Hugo, who says, lost causes are the only causes worth fighting. And I think that's true. I think that if you define the lost cause in the way most people think of it, as you're beating your head against the establishment, and you're fighting forces that are so much more powerful than you are, either politically or by money. But the one thing I have found in that vein is that, as a social and political activist, that the people I have dealt with in the political arena, in the social action, and certainly in the political arena, and even in the corporate area, many of them are very, very willing to support our causes. When we went around Route 128 talking to personnel, we were received very well by the corporate people. They tried very hard to see if we could get an employment express. One of my favorite people was the head of the people who worked very closely with us on employment was Walter H. Palmer, who was the head of the Massachusetts Association for Manufacturers. A marvelous person. So that I never had the feelings that on an individual personal basis that we were working against people who did not have the right attitude toward what we should be doing on the human rights level. But as institutions, the institutions were very difficult to deal with, whether it was the corporate institutions or a political institution, because once you get at the institutional level, you're no longer dealing with just an individual legislator or an individual, the president of a corporation. You're dealing with a policy-making organization, which involves many individuals who are opposed to the very thing that you want to accomplish. So those are the kinds of forces, and that runs through our entire society, I think, whether it be in the housing industry. We had difficulties with realtors, not with individuals, but the Realtor Association. There was redlining in Boston to prevent blacks from moving out of the ghetto.
Explain what redlining is.
Redlining is where the realtors would deliberately steer blacks into black neighborhoods and avoid bringing them into white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And this was true of banks as well. Blacks couldn't get loans. To start up a business in Roxbury was extremely difficult. And during the early 60s, in fact, a number of corporations sought to help startup companies in Roxbury. Digital Equipment Corporation. Digital Equipment stood out as one of the corporations that went out of its way not only to try to hire blacks here in the suburbs, which was difficult because they couldn't travel here, but to also provide contracts for startup businesses that could make products that Digital could use. I was working at Lincoln Laboratory and in the 60s, and I was able to who get a contract for a startup company called IOC, Input Output Corporation, which was a software company, which is still going. And it turned out the president was Tom Farrington, a black who lived in Concord, who moved to Concord. One of the success stories, he and his wife. In fact, his wife, I think, is quite active, has been quite active in his former wife. I don't know if they're still together in Concord affairs. But this is the sort of thing that we could deal with on individual level. But when you got to the corporate or the policy-making levels, that's where you're running.
Well, thank you.